It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear from a guest who says the State of the Union address doesn't tell us much, so we'd be better off with a presidential question and answer session.
First, a lot of young people get arrested in this country, young men in particular, and young black men most of all, according to a new report.
We've got a co-author of the report with us. Michael Turner is an associate professor of criminal justice and criminology at the University of North Carolina in Charlotte. He and his colleagues published their new paper in the journal Crime and Delinquency. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with some of the most surprising numbers, or they were surprising to me anyway. The arrest rates for young men of different races, people arrested by the ages of 18 and 23. Can you talk us through those main findings?
So we've looked at two different points in time, like you said, 18 and 23. This actually comes up from a follow-up study that we had published a couple of years ago that did not disaggregate on race and sex, that basically found about a third of individuals reaching the age of 23 were actually arrested at some point in their life. So we got a lot of comments, a lot of feedback asking how those arrest rates varied across race and sex. And just to jump forward on the 23-year-olds, the main finding I think people are most astonished by is that roughly about 38% of white males were arrested by the age of 23. Number in about mid-40s, 44%, I believe, of Hispanic males, and 49% of African-American males were arrested by the age of 23. So that seems to be the one in two seems to be capturing the people's interest in terms of African-American males.
Was this a surprise to you? I mean, all those numbers sound high. I think if you'd asked me before I saw this study, I would have guessed a lot lower for all three of those categories. Were you surprised that those numbers were that high?
Well, following from the prior report, no. When we first did the first study, I was surprised that it was about a third. So I will say that. So we knew that with males being a higher rate of individuals in terms of a higher rate of criminal activity, we figured the numbers for males would be higher than the 30%. So they're not really that big of a surprise for us, I think, overall.
Now, we're talking about arrest here. That can be a pretty wide range of situations. It doesn't mean in all cases jail time or prison or anything like that. It could be arrested but released immediately, all the way up to arrested and eventually convicted. Is that right?
That is correct. Actually, it's anything other than a minor traffic or major traffic violation. So it could be anything from drug violations to DUIs to all the way up to, you know, more serious types of violent crimes. So that we do not know. We do not know the types of crimes that these individuals were arrested for. And we also don't know if they were, you know, arrested and then released without ever actually being booked or whatever. So there's a lot of things that we don't know. We just know, since this is a survey methodology, we just know that at some point they admit to having been arrested.
And that could be arrested once or arrested 10 or 20 times.
That is correct.
Are there arguments within the academic world of criminal justice about whether too many people are being arrested? Is this number or something the case that it's too high?
I don't know if it's too high. I mean, I don't know what the right number is. I think there has been discussion. You see it in the educational literature as well about the zero tolerance policies that came into effect, I'd say in the last 10 or 15 years, that pretty much are intolerant of minor forms of behaviors in schools. So where maybe a fight between some kids in schools 20 years ago, individuals might be suspended, they actually might be arrested now. Or minor forms of drug possession, again, might have served a suspension a couple years ago or a couple decades ago, now is serving is turning into an arrest. So, you know, it's those types of things that a lot of folks in the educational literature have been talking about, how it's the zero tolerance policies leading to more strict forms of arrest and then actually getting individuals caught up into the criminal justice system.
So as you mentioned, we saw a lot more men reporting having been arrested than women. We saw this racial disparity among men, 38% of white men saying they'd been arrested compared to 49% of black men. Do you see that similar racial disparity, though, among women?
No, the actual women, white women actually scored the highest in terms of had the highest prevalence rate. And I believe, I don't have the study in front of me, but I believe black women actually had the lowest prevalence rate of arrest. But those percentages were only a couple percentages different. I believe white women were in the the low 20s, and the black women are in the high teens, I believe, if I'm not mistaken.
Looking into impact, your paper cites existing research into the effects of arrest on a young person's future. What, from the literature out there, what are some of the problems these arrests can lead to down the road?
Well, I think the first thing that comes to mind is employment. So, you know, a lot of folks, I mean, lots of folks out of jobs and folks looking for jobs, you know, employers are looking for ways in which to, you know, cut down the pool of individuals in terms of trying to find employees. So asking individuals if they have been arrested, which is traditional, it's not uncommon, but asking them if they've been arrested can have an impact on whether individuals can move forward into the employment world. So it might have an impact on their labor opportunities, their employment opportunities, but could also have a variety of other impacts. Particularly on housing, on adoption, on choice of mate. You know, I mean, you're asking individuals if they would choose an individual who had been arrested. It may impact individuals' decisions. So there's a lot of social circumstances that could evolve that may be impacted as a result of having that label of having been arrested.
It seems like when you're trying to figure out the impact of that initial arrest on someone's life, there's got to be a lot of chicken or the egg going on there. Is there something that happened before the arrest? Parenting, financial issues, abuse, bullying, things like that, that make it more likely that they'll have a bad life, including that arrest? Or is there something inherent in being arrested that's going to make your life work? Can you talk about teasing that out a little?
Yeah, we didn't look at that, but you're asking a really good question. So what I understand that you're saying is basically what are the things that might have occurred? I mean, arrest oftentimes doesn't occur in a vacuum. It can, but oftentimes it doesn't. That typically the individual is doing a variety of other things, and we know that individuals typically don't specialize. So there's probably a variety of other things that's going on in their lives, behaviors that they're getting involved in, that actually might warrant an arrest. Now, those things are also related, as you pointed out, to a variety of family circumstances, you know, socioeconomic status or circumstances, school-based circumstances, peers, all of those things that we know that are associated with an individual getting involved in delinquency and ending up in arrest. So you're right. There are a lot of things that may have been causally related to the arrest, but that's really not what our study focused on. Our study really was focusing on just trying to understand, hey, at a given age, in a given cohort, what proportion of that population at that age has actually experienced that arrest? So we haven't gone down in terms of trying to understand what were the causal factors related to that arrest.
Looking ahead from this research that you did, what do we know from this? Are there actions we can take based on the disparities that you found? Or what's the next step? What do we need to know with this as a starting point?
Well, I think one of the things that you see actually in the educational literature is schools are starting to back down from the zero tolerance policies. I think, you know, educational administrators are finding it a little frustrating that they have no flexibility and discretion in terms of dealing with their students. So I think what you see is a little bit of the waning of the zero tolerance policy. So that, and not as a result of this study, but coexisting at the same time as the publishing of this study. So there's a little bit there, but there's a lot of other questions that we don't really have a good handle on. And you touched on a couple of them earlier. I mean, what proportion has been incarcerated by a certain age? What proportion actually get bullied at various ages? And how might those effects of an incarceration or bully or suspension or anything like that, how might those things kind of affect the life course of the individual in terms of the path and the opportunities that they would have over the course of their life?
We're talking with criminology professor Michael Turner. He's the co-author of new research showing that large numbers of young men have been arrested by the time they reach age 23. Here are the numbers. Almost 40% of young white men, 44% of Hispanic males, just under half of young African-American men.
And we want to hear your thoughts, your questions, and experiences. Were you arrested in your youth, and how did it affect you? And why do you think so many young men are arrested in this country? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@wpr.org. We continue our conversation now with criminology professor Michael Turner from the University of North Carolina. He's co-author of a new paper showing high arrest rates for young men, with just around 40% of white men and half of black men facing arrest by the time they're 23.
And you can join the conversation. Are you surprised hearing those numbers? Once young people are in the criminal justice system, make that first contact by being arrested, what do you think it takes to get them back out? And if you are in law enforcement or maybe relevant social work or even faced arrest yourself early in your life, please call in and share your experiences. The number is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Joe with us in Eau Claire. Joe, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I guess a comment about my experience being arrested as a teenager and the effect that it's had on the rest of my life. When it comes to jobs, it has impacted my ability to find a job, even as an adult, so tremendously. I was arrested for minor THC charges when I was 17 or 18. I plead out to a plea agreement that eventually would expunge my record if I met certain conditions. And I found that actually never was expunged. It was deleted from the public record. If you go on a Wicca, you know, it's not there.
Mm-hmm.
But
if somebody does a criminal background check?
Exactly. It still shows up. And there's, I was actually surprised on the 46% of black males are arrested before 23. That's actually lower than what I would have expected. But the difference between the African American and white Caucasian young males there's a big enough difference there that still it should be alarming to most people. It looks like we still have a racial disparity when it comes to arrests. I think police officers are much quicker to arrest young African Americans. And finally, I think we just live in a police state. Now, that might sound really shocking to somebody because we live in a democracy, but a police state doesn't necessarily have to mean a dictatorship. And I think we've just sort of been the frog in the pot of boiling water. We haven't noticed it because it all grew up around us.
Gotcha. Joe, I want to jump in. You brought up a lot to talk about there. Where to start? Michael, one thing there, he's talking about the disparity in arrests between young white men, young black men. Is this something that you think, in aggregate, all put together, I mean, it might account for part of the economic future, the economic prospects, if you're a young black man or a young white man, this arrest disparity?
Well, absolutely it does, particularly for those arrested. But one thing I was going to say is, you know, there's two sides of that coin. So with regards to blacks being arrested at higher rates, one side of that coin says that perhaps, you know, there might be some racial profiling going on from the department, and that we seek out and might be quicker to arrest black males than white males, you know, accused of equal crimes. So that's one side of the coin. Or the other side of the coin is that black males might actually be committing crimes that are more arrestable and more that grab the attention more of the police, and might be more likely to get victims or witnesses to call the police when they see such crimes happening. And that we don't know the answer to. You know, I'm not saying that either of those answers is correct. I'm saying that we don't know what the answer is right now to sit and say that African Americans either are being targeted discriminatorily or that they're committing more serious crimes. We just don't know that. But nevertheless, at the end of the day, you're right that an arrest, as Joe just pointed out there, certainly has impacted his opportunities and his employment opportunities and his financial well-being. And I suspect that's true of a lot of individuals as well.
And Joe also mentioned that idea of having your record as a teenager expunged later. He, if we just went and looked him up online on the state database, he might not show up, but he says it hasn't been expunged from a criminal background check. Are states moving in the direction toward or away from expunging teenage criminal records, arrest records?
You know, different states have different laws and different processes in which how to expunge records. But what I always tell students in my class is that, look, in this day and age with computers, if you've been arrested, I would expect that everyone can find your arrest record at one point or another. And that seems to be consistent with what Joe's saying, that even though they told him it's expunged, even though he met the requirements, that overall, that if you look hard enough, you will find a record that indicated that he was arrested. And I tell my students the same thing.
We'll go back to our callers now. We've got Chris on the line joining us in Madison. Chris, hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, when I was, well, actually, my 18th birthday, I went out and bought a $500 worth of fireworks. That was like 40 years ago. And they weren't quite legal then, but what the hell, I bought them anyway. Mm-hmm. I lit them off, and I lit a bunch off, and next thing I know, I have a cop pulling me over and opened the trunk, and he had about a coronary because he figured I had about 4 sticks of dynamite worth of fireworks in the trunk of my car. Nowadays, if a kid did that, he would go to a federal prison for being a terrorist.
So you didn't have, you weren't arrested for that then, Chris?
Oh, I was arrested. I was taken to prisons or jail and booked in and spent the night. Got up the next morning. They saw the judge. He looked at me. He called me stupid. He gave me a $300 fine and 8 hours community service to shoot him off the next year for a fireworks celebration.
All right, Chris. Well, you got to see the fireworks after all. Michael, we've seen over the years, you mentioned zero tolerance in schools. We've also seen changes in criminal justice policy, minimum sentencing, 3 strikes. Are we more prone with that initial arrest, do you think, to see more punitive action from square one?
Well, I certainly think in the 80s we really started getting tougher on a lot of different types of crimes, particularly drug-related crimes, and particularly crack cocaine. So, yes, we have had a quote-unquote pardoning, you know, in terms of intolerance of certain types of activities. And those things change over the time. And I always describe it as kind of a pendulum effect that over time there will be always a softening and a hardening of certain types of crimes. And, you know, for the last, you know, 20 or 30 years, we seem to be in a point in which, you know, for certain types of crimes, we do get a little bit tougher on them.
Thanks for the call, Chris. We've got Mike in Madison on the line now. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Yeah, I think, you know, what the other caller mentioned about Wisconsin Circuit Court access is really doing our citizens of this state a disservice, putting all the arrest records, whether or not the person's found guilty or not, online. It's still, you know, can hurt an individual trying to find a job. You add that into the recall election petition. You know, people can search that now online database and determine whether or not they like your political viewpoint. Michael, I could look you up right now while we're talking here and see what your record is online and decide whether or not I want to hire you or not based upon what I see. I think that whole thing needs to be taken offline. There should be a fee to access the data. Hiring HR folks from out of state can search online for Wisconsin's database if the individual had any ties to Wisconsin and see if the person's ever been arrested.
Thanks for the call, Mike. I want to jump in. And Michael, thanks for sharing that thought, Mike. Michael, in our last minute or so, another topic I know you study is the factors that might lead people, young people in particular, away from crime once they've had that first arrest or that first offense. Briefly, are there some things that give you hope that first arrest doesn't have to lead to a future in the criminal justice system?
Well, yeah, I think there are some individual resiliency factors, if you will, or protective factors that might insulate you from, you know, kind of the things or the causal factors that might lead you to a life of crime. Things that occur within your individual self, incurring, you know, in your own psychology, your ability to overcome change, overcome challenges, There's some social things, you know, connections with families, things of those sorts, and, you know, connection with the community. Those things are all have been found to be insulative in terms of kind of protecting an individual from getting involved in serious types of crime.
Michael, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
That was Michael Turner. He's Associate Professor of Criminal Justice and Criminology at the University of North Carolina in Charlotte. We've been talking about a report he co-authored about arrest rates for young Americans.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, our guest says we shouldn't be pessimistic about the U.S. economy. We're on the verge of reinventing ourselves for the better.
First, President Obama will give his fifth State of the Union address tomorrow, and our guest says it will be little more than a presidential infomercial, more pep rally than policy launch.
So his solution is to turn the State of the Union address into a presidential Q&A, where he has to respond to questions from elected officials.
Here with us to explain his proposal is Doug Brooks, President Emeritus of the International Stability Operations Association. He wrote an opinion piece with Lawrence Korb in the Washington Post called Let's Turn the State of the Union into a Presidential Q&A. Doug, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, you say that the State of the Union address hasn't always been what you're calling a presidential infomercial. Can you give us a sense of what it used to be like?
Well, for about 100 years, it was little more than a letter that was sent by the president to be read by some flunky in Congress. Back in 1913, Woodrow Wilson sort of dusted off the idea of actually talking directly to Congress, and it became at that point, and pretty much on a fairly regular basis now, the president will actually address a joint session of Congress, and you include, of course, the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Supreme Court justices as well. But as we've seen, this sort of thing has degenerated literally into a pep rally where half the audience stands for some of his comments, the other half for others, and occasionally everybody stands for some of the comments to cheer. But it's it doesn't really seem to achieve much other than giving the president a chance to sort of, I guess, stand royally above old parts of the government and look in a way that I think Thomas Jefferson would have shunned.
Well, do you think the way it's done now is more just, you know, a comment on the way we do politics in America today and the partisan nature and the way it's so TV-centric rather than really a problem with the State of the Union?
Oh, no, that's probably true. But I guess, you know, what's the point and is the American electorate served by this format? And I don't think it's working particularly well. You see not so many people watching it, and as we say, you know, people are watching reruns of Breaking Bad and basketball games rather than but an address that could be, I think, quite interesting and quite enlightening in terms of what's going on with the government today.
In terms of the political stage, I mean, so much of it is canned, what we see. It's prepackaged. I mean, just about everything on TV is, including reality TV shows. So why should the presidential, you know, why should the State of the Union be any different?
Well, that's a great question. I guess there are some people who think maybe we could have something a little bit more substantive. You know, there's no guarantee that this sort of format would become substantive either. I mean, when you read the comments that we've received, that Larry and I have received on this this idea, a lot of them are saying it would degenerate into exactly what, you know, Fox News or MSNBC is, you know, every day. And that's quite possible. But nevertheless, I think there is a possibility that it could be taken seriously. Obviously, it's something that, you know, it's a thought piece. But if it was grasped onto and both parties said, okay, here's a chance to have some really dignified discussion, maybe something could be achieved. And maybe for an electorate, it might become a little bit more interesting and informative and useful in terms of, I guess, as we say, reinvigorating our democracy.
So you use the word dignified, and I'm curious about that because you propose something that's similar to the Prime Minister's questions in the House of Commons, and we actually have a clip of that. Let's take a listen.
Excellent.
Isn't it interesting, Mr. Speaker? The thing they want to talk about least of all is the cost of living crisis facing families up and down the country. And that's because they know that families are worse off. Yeah. Now, can he tell us, how much higher is the average gas and electricity bill this Christmas compared to last?
Well, first of all, let us deal with the predictions. Let us deal with the predictions. He said this.
Order. The question was asked, and the answer must be heard. The Prime Minister.
On this, they have a programme which will clearly lead to the disappearance of 1 million jobs. Now we have 1.6 million more private sector jobs, 1.2 million more people in work. It is time he apologised for his prediction of talking the economy down.
Now, that is a clip from the Prime Minister's questions. That was the Leader of the Opposition, Edward Miliband, asking a question to Prime Minister David Cameron. That was just last month. Now, I don't know, dignified is definitely rowdy, and there's some substance there. But what do you think that gives us that we don't get out of State of the Union?
Well, that's a great point. And actually, right after we posted our story, a friend of mine, an Australian friend, sent a clip from Australia, which was even more hilarious. Yeah, I mean, this is something that we need to avoid. Obviously, we'd like to. But, you know, as a fallback, it'd certainly be a hell of a lot more entertaining than what we currently have. So, you know, I think it's a win-win either way.
Well, what about the substance? Let's get at that, because you're calling the current State of the Union a presidential infomercial. How could what you're proposing, a presidential question and answer session, provide more substance for the people who are actually watching?
Well, think of it this way. We have three branches of government, and yet they rarely seem to actually talk to each other. I mean, this would be sort of, instead of talking through the TV shows, instead of talking through seconds, they'd essentially, you'd have an opportunity for the lawmakers and the president to be able to have a face-to-face and public conversation on the key issues. I think there could be some value in that. I think there's a lot of ideas that simply get shunted to one side or another, because if you're not being asked them directly, you don't necessarily have to answer directly. So it would be perhaps the only time when a president and Congress would actually face and talk to each other and have some sort of conversation. Now, obviously, it's incumbent upon, I think, the leaders of the parties and everything to agree that they want to do this in a dignified manner, but I think it could be done conceivably.
Now, in your piece, you say that it would cause the president to be quick on his feet. He would have to be, you say, quick and clever, and that kind of style would be what would serve it best. But, you know, obviously that's not going to serve all presidents equally, and it might not serve the cause of politics equally either if we reward the clever president over, you know, say, the wise and sagacious president.
The dumb one.
Your word, yeah.
Maybe
what
that's
do you
not
think?
A bad thing.
So you think that would cause the cream to rise to the top?
Oh, you would hope. It certainly might be a bit intimidating for some of the potential presidents in the future. But nevertheless, I mean, even a thoughtful president, I think, can probably pull it off. And again, a lot of it depends on the level of dignity you're able to achieve when you do this sort of thing. You know, if it is a circus, then, yeah, maybe just having a clown up there would be useful. But if it actually is something where real ideas are being thrown back and forth and discussed and debated right there, then maybe a thoughtful president could do just as well.
Who do you expect would moderate, and how would you get to pick who got to ask the questions?
Well, we propose it would be perhaps the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate, which is a vice president. But I think because of the two-party system, you'd probably want to have the leaders of both parties involved somehow. So most likely, in this case, it probably would be the vice president and the Speaker of the House. But it's conceivable in the future it could be, you know, the ranking member. There could be any numbers of ways that could be decided. I think it'd be important to make sure that the questions, that each party is able to control the questions and make sure that some of the so-called backbenchers are able to get their questions in, as well as the people that everybody sees on TV all the time. So I think it would open up the forum a bit more to representatives that we never really see.
Now, we have something kind of similar to this already. We have town hall meetings. How would this distinguish itself from that?
Well, true. And the town hall meetings, of course, are on a lower a political level, but this would be, yeah, very similar to that. It would be, again, it would be a chance where anything could be brought up. You'd presumably have some questions that would be pre-planned. In other words, if you have a fairly technical question, that could be given to the president, you know, a few days ahead of time to give him or her a chance to prepare. But there could be built into it, you could have a certain number of spontaneous questions, which would would be a little bit more challenging and interesting.
So let's say, you know, President Obama's listening right now. He thinks, pretty good idea. I think I might try this. And that's the way we do it. Probably not this year, tomorrow, but, you know, maybe next year. What would change? What would you expect to change?
I think that it would be very interesting, and it would be, I mean, obviously somewhat politically risky. I mean, this whole idea is a long shot. But I think for Obama, he is a clever, I think he is reasonably fast on his feet, and I think he would do well in this particular format. I mean, obviously, he'd have to spend some time prepping and making sure he has, you know, the right answers. But you do that in the political debates anyway, when you're running for office. So I don't think this would be that much of a challenge or that far outside of bounds. So I don't think there, you know, basically it would take some agreement ahead of time, which in this day and age may not be so easy to do, but some political agreement between both sides saying this is a way we want to go, this is something we want to try. And for the Republicans, I mean, they have a lot to gain from this. I mean, right now it's basically a mandatory session where everybody has to sit there stony faced while the president talks at you and provides his thoughts and his ideas and his successes and, you know, his challenges for the future. And it, you know, the answer that they have, the response, almost nobody watches, and is rarely as interesting or captivating as the original. So I think there's a lot for them to get out of it, and therefore they might be willing to agree to some certain guidelines on dignity, on making sure that it's done in a way that makes it valuable. For the president, it'd be a little bit of a reach, but I think he could create a something that would be of incredible value to our democracy for the future.
Well, Doug, it's an interesting idea. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a real pleasure.
We've been speaking with Doug Brooks, President Emeritus of International Stability Operations Association. He's proposing that tomorrow's State of the Union address be turned into a presidential question and answer session.
In the midst of the recovery from the Great Recession, there's a lot of pessimism about the United States economy out there, with continued long-term unemployment for many, concerns about jobs lost to outsourcing and technology, and rising income inequality, a likely topic tomorrow's State of the Union address.
But our next guest has an optimistic point of view. In a piece that recently ran in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, he says the U.S. economy is reinventing itself and good news is on the way.
Vivek Wadhwa joins us now from Singularity University. He's a fellow at the Rock Center for Corporate Governance at Stanford University and director of research at the Center for Entrepreneurship and Research Commercialization at Duke University. Vivek, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So as we mentioned, there's a lot of pessimism about the economy. Why don't you feel pessimistic?
Because the country is reinventing itself. If you look at every specific field, I mean, start with manufacturing. Manufacturing is beginning to come back to America. Give it another 5 years and we'll be having robotics manufacturing plants, and then we'll be building 3D manufacturing plants. We're going to have to start building new factories, training up American workers. We're going to see a revival of manufacturing like we've never imagined before. Look at medicine. There are all sorts of advances happening in medicine. We're now being able to prevent disease. We have all sorts of sensor-based devices which are available for our smartphones, for our bathrooms. All these amazing sensors which can help us prevent disease. Look at energy. Solar has dropped 97.2% over the last 35 years. At the rate at which solar is going, and I'm just talking just about solar, not about many of the other amazing advances, we will achieve grid parity in about 10 years or so. Grid parity means that it's cheaper to buy, to have solar panels than to buy from the grid. Move forward 15 years, and solar will be a fraction of grid. We're talking about unlimited energy. You have unlimited energy, you can have unlimited clean water, you can have unlimited food. The next 10 to 20 years are going to be the most amazing period in human history, and we're laying the seeds for all this innovation right now. America is making it happen.
But looking at manufacturing and other fields, a lot of people might look at this and say, it's great that the manufacturing jobs are coming, but thanks to technology, an individual plant employs fewer people. A lot of jobs, even starting to be knowledge jobs, are being crowded out by new forms of technology. These innovations may be great, but if we don't have jobs to make money, it could be bad news for a lot of people.
Well, I'll ask you the question, why do we have to work 40 hours a week? You know, 100 years ago, we would have been arguing about working 80 hours a week. We would have argued about the importance of protecting agricultural jobs. And then we would have been arguing about protecting factory jobs. Jobs have been changing over the last centuries. We work less now than we ever did. We have more leisure time. Why do we have to work 40 hours a week? Why can't we be working 20 hours a week? Why, you know, if food becomes cheap, if we can 3D print our houses, if we can prevent disease and we don't fall sick, why do we have to make money the way we do right now? We you know, next decade, we're going to be having some very interesting discussions about the value of work and the meaning of work itself. It's going to be changing. We'll be doing less work. We'll have more time for leisure. We'll have more time to uplift ourselves, to gain knowledge for music, for the arts. Those are better pursuits, you know, than just working in jobs that are mindless right now that people hate doing.
So it sounds like you're saying our technology is running out ahead of our economy and our culture, our society.
Exactly. And we don't seem to realize that as human beings, we tend to get pessimistic. We look linearly. Hey, the next iPhone didn't have a major new upgrade and we become pessimistic. You know, we have to understand that our iPhone now, for example, has 40 times the computing power of supercomputers of about 30 or 40 years ago. We just sit around, they just sit in our pockets waiting for us to do something. Computing has advanced exponentially, and so are many other fields. They're advancing exponentially. And we're now getting to a point that we'll be able to solve many of humanity's problems.
Part of the pessimistic viewpoint is along the lines of economist Tyler Cowen, who was on our show a couple of months back. He makes the case that there are some people who are going to do really well. People with education, people with skills, the people who are programming the apps, developing the new technologies. And there'll be a lot of people who can't afford an education to do that or rack up so much debt in education that they'll be burdened by it forever. Do you see that that split coming in our society?
Yes and no. I mean, Tyler is the guy who used to go around talking about how all innovation is dead. We picked all the low-hanging fruits of history. He was an extreme pessimist a few years ago. Now he's talking about, hey, all these amazing things are happening, but we're going to have unemployment. Tyler is selling books by being pessimistic. The fact is that when we start bringing manufacturing back, we have to build new factories. You don't have to. You don't need a college degree to build a factory. So we're now going to have to rethink our infrastructure, the way we have our roads. When we have self-driving cars on our roads, the job requirements will change. We won't need so many taxi drivers or so many truck drivers. It may well be that you have some people who pursue music and knowledge gathering. The jobs will change. The role of human beings will change. And yes, there will be disruption. There will be more people who are the extreme rich. We'll have more Mark Zuckerbergs. But the rest of, you know, for example, cell phones. 15 years ago, the cell phone used to be an object of luxury. If you go back to that movie Wall Street, Michael Douglas had that big brick in his hand, and that was the image we saw of the super rich. I was in New Delhi 2 weeks ago. My beggar's cell phone went off. He stopped begging. But the point is that now a billion people in India have cell phones. They've become objects of, they've become a sheer necessity. So the cost of technology is dropping. It's commercial. It's democratizing. Everyone is beginning to have it. And we're going to have different discussions than just having haves and have-nots. We're going to have the have-nots have so much more, knowledge, so much more food and lodging, and many of their basic needs will be taken care of. So it could well be that some people work more than others do, but it's going to be a set of very interesting discussions we have over the next 10 to 20 years.
One thing that struck me in your piece, we hear a lot about how the internet has changed the economy. You say we haven't seen much yet. It's still a really new technology in the scope of things. There's a lot more to come.
Yeah, you know, there are going to be 3 billion more people coming online in this decade. Cheap tablet computers. I was involved with a project to bring cheap tablets from India to Palo Alto, Oakland, and Mountain View. We gave it to the disadvantaged children over here. It's sad that there's tens of thousands of children over here who don't have laptops or computers, which are basic necessity. We brought $40 computers from India and gave it to these kids. Many of them said it changed their lives because now they had access to the same internet, to the same knowledge, to the same ability to build apps as the rich kids in Silicon Valley did. So the cost of tablet computers is dropping exponentially. Soon everyone will go around having iPad-like devices by which they communicate. Just like we have cell phones, we'll have smartphones and smart tablets, and they'll become inexpensive. The way we'll be able to communicate will just change. It's going to lead to an era of information sharing.
In our last 30 seconds or so, is the United States particularly well poised in this innovative future?
You know, that's the beauty of it. We're making this innovation happen. We are the inventors of this technology. We're going to be the leading beneficiaries of this thing. And the U.S. is reinventing itself once again. I'm extremely optimistic about America. It's going to rise. It's going to prosper. It's going to flourish.
Vivek, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Vivek Wadhwa. He's Vice President of Research and Innovation at Singularity University. He's also affiliated with Duke and Stanford universities.